Hi, welcome to Generation Squeeze's Hard Truths. I'm Megan Wilde. Today you'll get to hear from the closest thing Canada has to a federal watchdog for generational fairness. We were honored to speak with Jerry DeMarco, the Commissioner of the Environment and Sustainable Development in Canada's Office of the Auditor General. Commissioner DeMarco is a leading expert in environmental law and has been interested in intergenerational equity for much of his 25-year career.
There's a lot of different areas where intergenerational thinking, long-term thinking, could help us avoid mortgaging the future and, you know, extracting these short-term benefits that end up having a disproportionate impact on those who follow.
My co-pilot for this conversation was Andrea Long, Gen Squeeze's Senior Director of Research and Knowledge Mobilization. But before we get started, I wanted to make a quick plug for Generation Squeeze's first ever community call on November 16th. We hope you'll join us for this virtual conversation about generationally unfair policies that have contributed to today's housing, affordability, medical care, and climate crises. Check out gensqueeze.ca for more details. All right, now for Jerry DeMarco. Well, Commissioner DeMarco, thank you so much for joining us on Hard Truths. I would like to start by having you tell us just a little bit about your role at the Office of the Auditor General.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. And first of all, congratulations on undertaking the work that you do. It's very important. In terms of the work that I do, well, we do performance audits of the federal government, determine how well they're doing and accomplishing what they've set out to do in their objectives, in their programs, in their legislative requirements, and so on. We also monitor the progress and report on the federal sustainable development strategy and how well it's being implemented. And then very soon, we will start reporting under the Canadian Net Zero Act on Canada's performance in mitigating climate change. And our main audience is Parliament itself. So our reports go to the House of Commons and to the Senate, and then we are periodically brought into hearings to talk about what we found and our recommendations for the federal government to improve.
Can you tell us more about what influence do you have and what tools do you have at your disposal besides those reports and audits, or is that your main way of working?
Yeah, so in terms of decision-making power, our decision-making power is to decide what audits to perform and what issues to look at, but we have no power to actually change the federal government's course of action. So we have the power of information, but we don't have the power of decision-making. So we provide information to Parliament, and ultimately in a democratic society like here in Canada, the accountability does go with the government itself, the House of Commons and Senate. So we shine a light on the performance of Canada on environment and sustainable development. We issue these reports. We speak to the reports frequently in committee hearings at both the House and the Senate. But ultimately, the buck stops with government itself in terms of whether they want to listen to the advice that we have and the advice that the Auditor General has on all the other issues facing Canada. And that's the setup.
Well, you mentioned that key part of your function really is that shining a light, you know, spotlighting what Canada is doing, what Canada maybe could be doing more of. And that's, I think that actually really dovetails with a lot of what we're trying to do as well. Like, we're trying to shine a light to say, hey, folks, like, let's recognize some of these problems that we're facing have real generational implications as well. So you mentioned that you've been poking around our website, which is great. And you might have noticed that our vision of generational fairness is about sort of three main things: planning for all ages, being good stewards, and following the generational golden rule, which is treating other generations as you'd want your generation to be treated. So I'm curious as to how you might see that kind of vision of generational fairness intersecting with the principles of sustainable development.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you asked me to do this interview, because it caused me to reflect on, you know, my own learning journey and my own career. And I looked back at my academic writing on the issue, I guess it was now 20 years ago, in an environmental law journal about the incorporation of intergenerational equity and sustainability and sustainable development concepts into Canadian law. And at that point, when I was practicing law, You know, there were some good signs happening with the Supreme Court actually referring in a case that I was working on to intergenerational solidarity. And that was, you know, 2 decades ago. And then in a subsequent case, one of the last cases I worked on before switching from being a lawyer to an adjudicator, talking about how the government holds resources in public trust for the people. And so these issues that I was working on way back when as a litigator and writing about sometimes, they're now coming to the fore more, I find, in policy discussions and in conversations like we're having today, as we start to see the real negative impacts of the failure to plan far ahead and to look taking a long-term perspective on things. So going back again 20, 30 years ago, I never would have guessed as a young participant at the Rio conference in 1992, the Earth Summit, that Canada's greenhouse gas emissions would be higher now than they were then when we first committed to, and in fact were considered one of the leaders in terms of industrialized nations in pushing for action on both climate and biodiversity back then. And to think that we're now actually worse off than when we first committed to do it shows that we've, you know, as a country, made lots of commitments to sustainability, lots of commitments to addressing the crises of climate change and biodiversity. But in terms of performance, which is what I measure at our office, the performance hasn't been there. And that's quite unfortunate. We now see that concerns that we had back, you know, when I was a student in 92, they're happening now, right? There's more extreme weather this summer, in particular in Canada, has seen an abundance of wildfires and so on. So all of these worries that we had that seemed more academic or perhaps far off, a generation later, which is now, that's all happening. And these are the consequences of that failure to take the long-term view. The good thing, though, is that now people are taking the issues more seriously. The challenge is the scale of the problem has increased dramatically since those first commitments by Canada and its international partners to stem the tide of climate change and loss of biodiversity back in the early 90s.
Yeah, that long-term thinking is a critical part of our perspective as well. And we're really, I think part of what we're doing is really trying to encourage governments, as you do, to introduce that sort of long-term perspective into their decision-making. So, you know, what would be the impact of decisions made today, not just on the people around today, but the people who are going to be inheriting the impacts of those decisions now and into future generations. So given your experience trying to embed that notion of long-term thinking through the lens of sustainable development and the kind of audit and performance review functions that you're playing, what mechanisms do you really see as having like potential to try and shift some of those short-term electoral cycle kind of priorities that are so central to the way in which our political system operates? What other choices might there be to try and shore up our focus on long-term thinking?
Yeah, and you know, I've already seen encouraging signs as commissioner, and I've been in the role for a little over 2 years at the federal level. The first report I released where I was there from the beginning of it was back in 2021, and it was lessons learned on climate change. And we decided for the 8th lesson to focus on surfacing the problems of short-termism in government. And we said in that report that governments often struggle with long-term problems. Governments and those who wish to form a government often plan around the next election rather than on long-term challenges. And then within government, in terms of the public service, they often also favor short-term thinking at the expense of long-term planning. And we've said in that report that that sort of approach unfairly burdens future generations who will experience greater effects from long-lasting greenhouse gas emissions that have already been emitted in Canada. So we tried to make it explicit in that report that these overarching issues like lack of coordination amongst government departments, lack of leadership on climate change, for example, or in this case, lack of a long-term view, that these were really hampering Canada in its efforts to address long-term and intergenerational issues like climate change and biodiversity loss. I was really happy to see, following one of our appearances before a Senate committee, we were actually invited to speak about one of our very specific reports on the potential for hydrogen to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but their questions were much broader than that. And that Senate committee recently released a report, and I was really happy to see them take a much longer term view than you typically do see in government reports. And I'll read out that recommendation to give you an example of a government institution, in this case, the Senate, which is part of the Parliament of Canada, adopting a much more long-term view than you might expect. So the recommendation number 4 in the hydrogen report was that the government must present credible economic and energy transformation plans for achieving net zero in 2050 and any interim targets along the way, informed by the commissioner's comments about factoring in the environmental, economic, and social costs and the negative externalities that are not captured by carbon pricing, and the negative temporal externalities that are borne by future generations. So to see the Senate taking that view and looking at, you know, not just externalities, but what I call temporal externalities, which essentially are mortgaging the future for the short term, we're seeing now some uptake in that. Now, obviously, the Senate isn't as bound by election cycles as the elected House of Commons, so it would be nice to see committees of the House adopting that long-term view. But this is a start. So we're now seeing major institutions in Canada, the Senate, taking a very long-term view and asking the government or recommending to the government that they make a plan for net zero and that they explicitly factor in short-term gain causing long-term pain. In terms of other options, you know, there's other models around the world. You can have parliamentary committees that are focused on sustainable development and generational equity. You can have commissioners, like in Europe, Future Generations Commissioner, like in Wales. There are a lot of different ways of doing that. They can be advocates, they can be policy advisors, they could be auditors, like I am. But I think when the world gets together and finally adopts the Declaration on Future Generations, which may happen as early as next year, then I think you will see a proliferation of institutional responses from governments. Some will just incorporate it into their day-to-day business without creating a new institution. Others will probably create commissioners like ours or those in Wales or Hungary or Gibraltar, the ones that already have them.
Yeah, I think it's really important that you point to the Wales example. We actually recently had the Wales Commissioner of Future Generations on the podcast as well and had a really super interesting conversation with him about his role and how he's able to, you know, play a role across not just governments, but all sort of public bodies to encourage them to balance the interests of current folks who are alive today and those who are going to be around in future decades and centuries. So I totally agree with you. That's a really interesting example. So I'm kind of curious about, one, I wonder about how you see your role compared to the commissioner in Wales. Is it a really important difference to have a commissioner for sustainable development as opposed to a commission for future generations? Or do you think that's really more of a rhetorical difference? Because, of course, sustainable development does have that sort of underlying concern with preservation and sustainability now and into the future. So I'm wondering about that. And then I'm also wondering about a specific recommendation that we're pushing right now around creating what we're calling a Generational Fairness Council as a body that can exist within government structures to provide that kind of ongoing advice function, talking about what some of the intergenerational tensions might be in our policy decisions and providing suggestions and recommendations on how we could adapt or design policies to mitigate some of those tensions.
Yeah, great question. And the I guess this area of endeavor is too early. It's too nascent a situation for me to say, oh, here's the best practice that you should adopt and so on. I think we're still in the experimentation phase in terms of commissioners. The fact that I could mention most of the other commissioners in one relatively brief sentence is a sign that it's not gone mainstream yet. But the distinction between a commissioner of, say, of sustainable development and a commissioner for future generations, there is a distinction, although in Canadian law, the definitions of sustainable development and intergenerational equity are almost exactly the same. So they're very, very related, at least in the Canadian context. But the distinction is more important in terms of the role. So say you have a commissioner for future generations that is advocating for them and standing up and being their representative and being their advocate and so on. That's a different role than, say, an auditor who's looking at the existing commitments of the government and then measuring the gap between, you know, the objective being sought and the actual performance on the ground in terms of what's being accomplished. And that's, again, different from, say, a council or an advisory committee that is providing expert advice to a minister or to a cabinet or something on an issue. All of those roles are important. It's interesting that the documents from the late 80s and early 90s that led to the creation of my position, Parliament was struggling with how many of these roles to put into the commissioner's role and how many to leave for others, because it's difficult to be the objective and impartial performance auditor and to also be the advocate for a constituency and also to be the advisor to the institutions that you're auditing. So you can't do all of those things. And so you may need a range of roles. And so the council that you're speaking about, they may fit well within, you know, that advisory role that it would benefit the Canadian government in terms of getting more expert advice on how to deal with this issue. It would probably complement our role. We would still be doing our measuring of performance. And you could also have another person who's doing the advocacy. When they created this position as commissioner, the government response to the parliamentary committee report on the issue said, okay, this commissioner is going to be within the audit shop and going to focus on looking at the government's performance and reporting to parliament on that. The role of advocating for the environment and carrying out the environmental agenda, that's for government to do. So we're going to retain that role. Some would argue now, after 20 years of this and seeing Canada's relatively poor performance on climate change in particular, with our emissions rising over the last 2 to 3 decades, that leaving it to government hasn't necessarily solved the issue and there may be a need for more action. I think that there was an implicit admission of that with the passage of the Canadian Net Zero Act in 2021. There was a recognition that leaving it to government within policy and within its discretion to do the right thing on climate hadn't resulted in any reduction in greenhouse gas emissions from 1992 to 2021. And so they've tried to create a legislative basis for action. It's still up to the government, though, to carry that out. And it'll be up to our office to call them into account if they don't meet their objective. So I encourage you to look at the options that you have that you're advocating for in terms of a council, commissioners, and so on. Look at some of the models that are out there. But there is no best practice that I'm aware of that has shown itself yet to have fully accomplished your objective of the full integration of future generations into government decision-making and somehow cracking that nut of overcoming the short-termism that's typically inherent in the way governments operate. That's a big challenge. And with climate, biodiversity, and other social and economic issues, it's becoming more and more difficult because the scale of the problems have increased. But as I said earlier, the recognition of the problem and some public support for the need to change has also been increasing. And so we may see more action on that in years to come.
The way that we actually found out about your position is we looked into a international group called the Network of Institutions for Future Generations. So we are curious about what Canada's participation in that group means and what potential does that network have to advance generational fairness in Canada?
Yeah, so the vision of that network, and our office is a part of it, is a world where future generations' rights, interests, and well-being are incorporated into the governance frameworks. So we bring together, it's a forum of institutions like ourselves and Wales, parliamentary committees like in Scotland and so on. Really, it's about us, working together on better incorporating future generations' thinking or long-term thinking into government institutions like ours, the Auditor General's Office or parliamentary committees and so on. And the fact that the network isn't that big is a sign that there's a lot of work to do, right? So it's good that it's growing, but I don't think it's really going to, explode as an issue that people are taking seriously across the world until we see that progress at the UN level, which I think is imminent. And then you're going to see, just like after the Climate Convention and the Biodiversity Convention, you saw the domestic incorporation of mechanisms to address it. Not very well addressed in Canada in terms of performance, but certainly addressed into our legislative basis. So you'll see that as well happening on the issue of generational fairness. And it won't just be about environment and sustainable development, right? I mean, there are economic and social issues that have an intergenerational component to them. I happen to specialize in the environment and sustainable development area. And so I look at the intersection between intergenerational thinking and intergenerational equity and the environment. But, you know, there's the fiscal angle and the social angle as well. And with respect to Canada's unfortunate history, there's also the intersection between intergenerational equity and reconciliation as well, in terms of the treatment of Indigenous peoples by those who colonized North America more recently. So there's a lot of different areas where intergenerational thinking, long-term thinking, could help us avoid mortgaging the future and, you know, extracting these short-term benefits that end up having a disproportionate impact on those who follow, either having to pay our actual debts in terms of the fiscal angle or paying for the environmental debts of a, you know, an overheated planet or impoverished natural heritage in terms of biodiversity loss. So these are some of the things that need to be addressed, but our institutions have not been set up to deal with these really long-term impacts. When we didn't have the technology to create multi-decade or multi-century messes for others to clean up, then there wasn't necessarily a need to have institutions that could deal with that. But now that we do have that ability to create these long-term problems, we need to harness our ingenuity to figure out the ways of addressing them. And that's the big challenge right now. And time is getting short as the planet heats up and as we lose species and the clock is ticking for sure.
And since you've been in this field for decades now, you've probably seen it seems like sustainable development originally just kind of referred to environmental problems. That's where we thought about sustainable development and sustainability. But now the sustainable development goals encompass so much more than just the environment, like poverty, they're at the top of the list. So I'm just curious about your thoughts on this evolution of core principles of sustainable development extending beyond the environment. And even this term future generations, like, is that just a shift in terminology? Have we just evolved beyond sustainable development, maybe because it didn't do what we hoped over those 20 some odd years? And now we're talking more about future generations instead. Sorry, that's kind of a vague question, but you have such a long-term perspective on this, these changes that I'm curious about.
Yeah, and I was thinking about that quite a bit. You know, so my inroad into what turned out to be my field of endeavor for my entire career was through the biodiversity angle, although I don't think I ever used that term until I was an adult. But, you know, I was interested in nature growing up outside the city. And I think I would call it now some sort of intergenerational resentment over, you know, what I read about, you know, what North America had looked like not that long ago in terms of the passenger pigeons, huge herds of bison, the super abundant cod, and so on, all of these things that are now in the history books. Well, the passenger pigeon is entirely extinct, and bison and cod are less than 5% of their former population. So I had this, you know, I almost was mad at the early European colonists who came to North America and somehow wasted away this incredible bounty that had been sustained for thousands of years, or longer than that. But in a fairly short period of time, and with the case of the passenger pigeon, going from billions of passenger pigeons to zero, it seemed to be astounding that humans could have done that. And not only had the ability to do that, but also the ability to do that without stopping before it was too late. It just seems impossible that the most common vertebrate in North America has disappeared. And, you know, I read about the passenger pigeon as a kid, and I used to stare at a museum specimen of it when I would go to a nature center. I just thought that, you know, what are humans doing? And now, as an adult working in the field, as bad as the situation was with the extinction of the passenger pigeon, we're now fundamentally altering global cycles like the carbon cycle and the water cycle and so on. And it's a scale that's even larger. So I got into this, you know, through the biodiversity interest. And I think it was actually in the 2 years leading up to the Rio Earth Summit in 1992, and I was working on that as a graduate student, that I started to see those connections between the economic and social and environmental, because I used to think of, you know, environment more as a niche issue. often competing against social and economic priorities as opposed to dovetailing with them. But my thinking on that changed as I studied it more and then worked in the field in the early days of my career. And through lenses such as the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals and Agenda 2030 or the Millennium Development Goals, or going way back to Agenda 21 from Rio, you could see that if you take a long-term view, then the social, economic, and environmental objectives tend to dovetail with one another as opposed to being working at odds against each other or trading off against one another. And that's the view that I take now, is that most economic and social objectives will be enhanced by work protecting the environment as well. So if we protect the environment for future generations, we're more likely to also improve, you know, matters of social justice or the economic well-being of an economy based on sustainable use of resources than, you know, the boom and bust cycles of frontier resource extraction approaches that have characterized many countries around the world, including Canada. And so I'm a firm believer that integrating the social, economic, and environmental objectives into a framework, whether it's the Sustainable Development Goals at the UN level, whether it's the Federal Sustainable Development Strategy in Canada, a well-being index that the Canada uses as well. If we can bring those things together, coupled with a long-term view, then it can be a win-win-win situation as opposed to a trade-off situation. It's not true of every issue, but it certainly the longer-term view you take, the more likely it is that those three issues, the objectives relating to those three issues, will coalesce rather than be opposing. So we as an office, and this is before I started, taken a lead amongst audit institutions to factor in the Sustainable Development Goals into all of our audit work. And that's not just the work of the commissioner that I do, but also the work of the Auditor General. So she's issuing reports to Parliament, just like I am, on issues relating to the economy, defense, health, education, and so on, all of the other issues beyond those that I report on. And you will see in many of her reports direct reference to the Sustainable Development Goals and how working on an issue that seems to be separate from, you know, the environmental sustainable development notion that you were talking about really are related to this broader notion of sustainable development. It's an issue that we really tried to emphasize last year in our comments on the then draft Federal Sustainable Development Strategy, which was quite weak on the social and economic. And, you know, even though my background is in environment, I didn't say, oh, well, that's a good strategy. You've got lots of stuff there on the environment. They did, but they didn't have very much on social and economic. So the focus of my input was mainly on the failure of that draft strategy to properly embrace the three aspects of sustainable development, the social, economic, along with the environmental. It was mainly an environmental strategy that used some of the lingo from sustainable development, but it didn't have the content. There were some improvements made because we made our comments before it was finalized. The current Federal Sustainable Development Strategy does have some economic and social components to it, which were not present in the draft, but they've got a long way to go to make it a true sustainable development strategy as opposed to an environmental strategy with a couple of aspects that are related to social and economic issues. I'm hoping that the next cycle will be the one where you see a full integration of the social, economic, and environmental aspects into the Federal Sustainable Development Strategy and a full integration of that strategy with Canada's commitments on the Sustainable Development Goals.
Yeah, well, I think we definitely would share your hope for that vision of the next iteration of the strategy and how we can use it more broadly, thinking about sustainability, you know, widely, not just in terms of environmental goals. And it kind of calls to mind for me a quote from your paper that you mentioned already from like 20 years ago that I just completely love. And here it is. More explicit use of intergenerational equity principles would help bring the focus away from simply sustainable development to a broader notion of social, economic, and environmental sustainability. So I think that's actually a really nice way of sort of in some ways wrapping up our conversation, because it takes the work around sustainable development and the evolution of that concept from being more than just about, you know, environmental well-being to social and economic and cultural and, you know, resisting colonialism and all those kinds of well-being, and links it with this notion of how the intergenerational tensions and the lack of fairness and equity and our what we're passing on to future generations and leaving for them, you know, is really sort of foundational to that. So I'm wondering if we could just talk a little bit about, you know, you're coming from a background of legal precedents that exist around intergenerational equity and around sort of environment and sustainable development. You've mentioned, of course, that, you know, there's more than just the climate risks facing future generations. That's not the only aspect of a problematic legacy that we're leaving. There's also, you know, growing government debts and other things as well. So, like, what's the potential for those legal pieces, those legal precedents to be used to apply to other kinds of intergenerational tensions? You know, they may have grown out of the environmental law kind of field, but do you see them having potential to apply to things like, you know, how are we creating such a wildly unaffordable housing market so that, you know, young folks can't even contemplate the idea of owning a home? Or, you know, how are we leaving so much debt without any conversation about revenue and you know, growing expectations for, you know, the aging population and the programs that, you know, they're relying upon? Do you think there's potential there?
Yeah. And you know, it's funny, Andrea, when you asked me to do this, I found that old journal article on the shelf. I was actually a little bit shocked that 20 years ago I was referring to global biodiversity loss and climate change as crises, because I was thinking that I'd used that term much more recently than that. And then the quote that you had there, too, I was thinking it seemed more recent, but I guess it's because I'm getting old that I had thought of these issues quite a while ago. But regardless, the fact is you know, we've known about these issues for quite some time. I had forgotten how long ago that I was thinking about it in these same terms, that largely the same terms that we're talking about today. The issues have become more mainstream and more tangible, especially on the climate change and biodiversity loss issues. But the role of institutions, including courts and legislatures, so you were talking about law in particular, they are key to it. Whether law reflects the way that society is moving and sort of catches up, or whether the law leads it and then pulls people along, it depends on the situation and how forward thinking in terms of law reform, how forward thinking the particular legislature is. In some ways, when you think about Canada, we were pretty leading edge in terms of pushing for action on climate change and biodiversity, hosting the first climate conference in 1988, and then being an integral part of the push for the Global North countries to sign on to the conventions in Rio. Since that time, unfortunately, we rested on our laurels too much and didn't follow up the talk with the action. That's led lots of people to seek recourse to the courts, something that I used to do early in my career. What I'm really interested in now is the standing of youth. You know, future generations themselves can't physically be in court, but the closest to them are the youth of today, and they are expressing their disappointment with the legacy being left to them by their parents' generation and their grandparents' generation, and seeking to use these, you know, longstanding institutions like courts to hold governments to account, to hold corporations to account, and you're seeing some success in that. Ideally, if it really is something that society as a whole is concerned about, it shouldn't be left entirely to the courts to remedy. It should be something that, you know, parliaments around the world address in a proactive way. And, you know, you could incorporate intergenerational equity into the law of Canada immediately if a majority of parliament wanted to do that. And you may not need to seek recourse to the courts to do that. But yeah, I think with the seriousness of the climate change crisis and the biodiversity crisis and all of the other intergenerational equity issues, you're going to see a range of interventions, whether it's pushing for new laws, asking the courts to strike down government action or to make a declaration regarding government inaction, asking the courts to force polluters to pay the full cost of their operations, and so on. All of these things are happening around the world. I think right now what we're seeing, especially with the youth of today, is that they aren't just accepting the inevitability of each generation having a more impoverished natural heritage and an atmosphere with more and more greenhouse gases. They're saying this is not acceptable, and not just from their own self-interest, but on behalf of the generations that are unborn. And that's a positive sign to me. I wish that it had not got to the crisis point, whether the current crisis point or the crisis point that I perceived to exist 20 years ago, but it has. And crises are terrible, but they do tend to spur action.
I know we had only 5 more minutes, but especially your story about the passenger pigeon really got me, because I remember very vividly a moment when I was probably just first grade and I got a magazine that was about extinct animals and having this visceral horror at they're gone. These animals are gone. I'll never get to see them. This is so unfair. And yeah, feeling this anger, and that motivated me probably to this day. So I guess, like, even the report you did about progress on climate, I'm trying to find the quote, because you used two terms to describe it. That one we see a lot about a rapidly closing window for action, but you also brought up how it's an intergenerational crisis. And I'm just really curious, like, why did you use that term, the intergenerational crisis, and how do you think we can get more people to recognize that dimension of this and feel that horror that we felt as kids at it's not just the action that's needed. It's what's really at stake here is so profound.
Yeah. Yeah. And my thinking on that has changed over time. I sort of looking back retrospectively with that, as I think I termed it today, as intergenerational resentment to those who had caused the losses that I was reading about in, you know, magazines or books that describe the, you know, the massive flocks of passenger pigeons that could take over a day to fly overhead with hundreds of millions or even billions of birds, and thinking, you know, how could we have done that? You know, how could it go from that species being super abundant for tens of thousands of years or hundreds of thousands of years to the loss of the last one in the Cincinnati Zoo? So one of the things that caused me to, you know, sort of change my perspective about it is sort of to try to make sure that we don't do that sort of thing to future generations so that they don't resent us, except for, unfortunately, we're, as I said before, we're working on a much larger and more catastrophic scale in terms of global biodiversity loss and global climate change. But I find that, you know, my thinking on it changed. Just the simple fact going from, you know, a child being interested in this issue and not being able to see the extinct species that had been present in decades or centuries before, to a young student thinking about, you know, what legacy are we going to leave in terms of the planet and protecting what we have, to a parent. And that certainly changed my view quite a bit. As you yourself become responsible for one small component, or in our case, two small components of the next generation, you think about things much differently in terms of, you know, what are we doing to the planet such that the basis of life in terms of biodiversity and climate, in terms of providing clean air, clean water, and the food that we, you know, the necessities of life are dependent on the systems that we are impairing now. What are we doing? How can we, as an intelligent species, collectively, you know, be dooming ourselves to that sort of future? And I don't think we are inevitably dooming ourselves to that sort of future. I still have some hope that, you know, we're not going to recover the species that have lost, and we're not going to immediately bring down the greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere, but we can bring down current emissions to the point that the climate will restabilize at some level that's not catastrophically warm. So there is some hope there. And I think the more that we think about the children that are to come and what sort of environment they're going to live in from a social, economic, and environmental point of view, the more we will be motivated to turn the ship around and to actually leave a positive legacy. Because of the inertia of, you know, the greenhouse gas is in the atmosphere and the long time, the evolutionary periods that take in terms of biodiversity, we're not going to actually have a better planet for them for some time, but we can actually make the investments now so that the future will be first less disastrous than it could be, and then eventually, you know, restabilize to something that more of a sustainable existence than one that's focused on short-term thinking at the expense of long-term interests. So there is hope. I think humankind, through institutions that we've talked about today and through the individual behaviors of all of us, can look far ahead and we have that ability to do it. It's really whether we're going to take the actions that are necessary to turn that thinking into concrete results that will protect the interests and rights of the generations to come.
All right, that seems like a wonderful place to wrap up, but I just want to quickly check if there's anything we didn't talk about that you really wanted to bring up with us.
No, I think we've covered off everything that I can think of, and the more people that you bring onto your podcast, the more there'll be that critical mass of people thinking about this. And it's not a big stretch for a lot of people. You know, we think about our children's education, we think about our pension, we think about our retirement. We are thinking about long-term issues every day or most days in our lives, but governments don't necessarily often think in those long terms. So it's kind of ironic that the institution that's protecting the public commons is often the one that's actually discounting the future at our own expense. But they are our elected representatives, and they are the institutions that are representing the collective will of the people. So if enough people are concerned about these issues, it's inevitable that the institutions will act on them more seriously.
Thanks so much to Commissioner DeMarco for joining us, and to all of you for listening. You can learn more by looking in the show notes or our website, gensqueeze.ca. And please don't forget to mark your calendars for our community call on November 16th.